Good morning, welcome all. I'm Ted O'Toole, guiding teacher, and I am happy to introduce a guest speaker today, Wendy Lewis. Thank you so much for coming, Wendy. And good to see your face.
Yeah.
First time I've seen it. Wendy has been practicing at San Francisco Zen Center since 1987. That included 6 years of living at Tassajara, a rural retreat center that many of you are familiar with. And she was ordained by Mel Weitzman and received Dharma transmission from Linda Cutts, and is in the Shunryu Suzuki lineage. She has a master's in theology that arose out of her interest in training priests, and also is interested in chaplaincy training. She's a sewing teacher and a web editor at San Francisco Zen Center. So she's held a number of leadership positions at that center over the years. And welcome.
Thank you very much. So again, good morning and welcome from all different time zones. I want to thank you for visiting me to speak here today and for the chance to meet everyone, see people, a few people I know. I'm going to speak today about the concept of self and no self in Buddhism and Zen, some of the contradictory aspects of that are the teachings on karma and how karma works. If there's no self, how can there be karma? And the bodhisattva ideal, like how can you be a bodhisattva if there's nothing to become a bodhisattva? Those kinds of questions that are part of the teaching on no self. And what the instructions towards maturity and enlightenment are referring to in the absence of a self. So that's the sort of overview. The no-self doctrine is based in a kind of deconstruction of our sense of a self to what they call the five skandhas. That's form, sensations or feelings, perceptions, formations, and consciousness. And that's a very basic level at which those things function, not, you know, sort of feelings like emotions and that sort of thing, but just sensation itself. And same with the other aspects. And these aspects, when you see them as impermanent and shifting all the time, then how does that undermine our efforts to reify and justify our actions and thoughts that arise from them? So if they're impermanent, the very basis of ourself, so the negative and positive consequences of kind of deconstructing down to those basic elements of a being, I guess you could call them, can result in a kind of sense of vulnerability and uncertainty, like, okay, then which direction am I going, or should I go, that sort of thing. And most importantly for the Buddhist proposal is the teaching on no self is the insight into the possibility of transformation. So as you sink down to those form, feelings, perceptions, formation, consciousness, that's where that potential is for transformation, enlightenment, realization. Because when we start to pile all the necessities of survival and connection onto those five skandhas, everything gets very complicated and judgmental and sensitive and puzzled and confusing and controlling. Because we have to survive, we have to survive, and then those activities bind us to, you know, not non-transformation, essentially, in clinging instead. So in the midst of this philosophy, though, there's personality, of course. This combination of our traits and our strategies for dealing with impermanence and the constant unfolding of reality in our lives. Like sometimes seems overwhelming how little control we have over everything. You know, sometimes that heartache of what happened to the world or to our friends or something like that, and that inability to do something really, because those things are going to happen. Human condition. So there's nowhere else to go, and yet maybe there's this tendency to imagine that there is. And that when we get to this place, nothing will bother us anymore. Of course, we usually don't think, and I won't bother other people. But so that starts to be part of it too. You start to realize that, oh, you know, this is all functioning between us. But you think, okay, in this place where I would go, who else would be there? How would they act? How would they relate to me? And can you create a test version, you know, to see how it works? I think sometimes we do that with Sangha. We kind of create it as a place that is sort of sort of assumed that it'll be safe, it'll be, will be included, that everyone will be our friend. And that's not how things work, not because anything's wrong, but that's not very developmental. You actually have to have friction and confusion in a certain way. And I'll talk about that a little more. So, although, you know, we think of transformation and realization and enlightenment as something like an achievement, or that our sense of self will actually resist enlightenment because it's so disconcerting when that deconstruction starts to happen, that we just, no, not right now, or something like that. We might not put it into words, but that pulling back. So I think part of the teaching of no self is to start to develop a sort of courage or lack of fear of consequences about releasing ourselves from habits, basically. So that the resistance is part of the functioning of karma. So that's the tendency to settle into our habitual behaviors and assumptions about how reality works. And our interpretations of reality and experience, and also our repetitive patterns, including our thoughts, which we are familiar with from meditation instruction. And it also means that our concept of a bodhisattva arises from those same habit assumptions. So we don't really know, we can't really know what a bodhisattva is, but we project that onto the ideal of a bodhisattva. And I'll talk about that a little bit. So I think of karma as basically teaching and recognizing interconnectedness. So that's partly understood through self-knowledge. So as we become familiar with our own habit patterns through applying wisdom teachings like karma, the four foundations of mindfulness and the four noble truths, it becomes clearer and clearer that sort of ameliorating the effect of habit requires compassion or a kind of unusual acceptance for both ourselves and others. There's a book called, it's about many different philosophers, and it's called Examined Lives, From Socrates to Nietzsche. Hope I pronounced that correctly. James Miller is the author, and he says, if the quest for wisdom about the self begins with heroic anecdotes, for us that would be the Bodhisattva or the Buddha, that sort of thing, it quickly devolves into a search for abstract essences. For numerous Greek and Roman philosophers, one's true self is immaterial, immortal, and unchanging, sort of a sense of a soul, self. But that is not the end of the story, since inquiry into the self eventually encounters and is forced to acknowledge the apparently infinite labyrinth of inner experience. In the unfolding history of philosophy, there emerges a picture of the human being as a creature in flux, a pure potentiality for being. So this apparently infinite labyrinth of inner experience, I was thinking how, you know, this provides another conundrum for regarding the teachings on no self. And I was thinking there's no way to completely eavesdrop even on our own thoughts and where they come from and how they develop and where they go and how they manifest. There's no way we can completely follow that process and definitely can't read it in others. So it seems as if each individual in their outwardness, what we think of as a self, is holding a piece of everyone. You know, we all have those potentialities in us to act in that way, speak that way, think that way. And so that's another way of seeing interconnectedness, which sort of relieves us from being tied to ourself, because everyone's doing it, you know? It's not like we're the only ones. And part of the way we are is also part of everyone else. So I, like the friend I'm staying with right now, she's very outgoing and has all kinds of friends and is always on the phone. That's so much opposite of the way I am, you know? And, but I sometimes do that, and it's very nurturing, and it changes me in good ways, you know, sort of having those interactions, like working as a chaplain and doing that master's of theology, I had to be always contacting and connected to people. So in a way, I know that she also spent many years practicing here at MZMC and even considered ordination. So she has that, you know, sort of tendency toward the cave. I know she also has that. So that's just a simplistic way of looking at it, but we each hold that, and we can learn from each other, I think, too. So even personalities that we dislike, we can see that in ourselves and maybe find some forgiveness for all the, you know, how people sometimes dislike us for who knows what reason, because of the way we are. And so then, how do you relieve that tension, that separateness, except by taking it on as part of oneself as well? Something like that. So I think that for those who've worked with the 12 steps for addressing addictions, it's a similar process to karma, that you, realizing that your habits, which we consider to be based in greed, hatred, and delusion, or passivity in Buddhism, When you realize those habits, you decide to apply these teachings and develop skills that reduce the impact on both yourself and others of the effects of the consequences of the repetitiveness of our karmic actions. And so this often seems like a reconstruction process and a sort of neutralization of the self. But through the process, and this is usually over quite a long period of time, I don't think it matters when you start, if you start young, middle-aged, or older, it's a period, it requires a period of time. But what develops is not perfection, but what you could call authenticity, and I'm sure you've heard that before. But this is a combination of what develops is trustworthiness, faith, vitality, and I think a kind of acceptance or, what do you call it, accommodation of awkwardness. Because we're all have differences, there's that awkwardness is going to happen, and we don't know each other, so there's awkwardness and diffidence and that sort of thing. But I think that that becomes a little it just becomes a little more normal, you know, part of it. Like you go through the awkwardness and then maybe learn something or maybe feel bad or whatever, but you just do it. Just say, okay, that's it. Accept it. And then trustworthiness and faith and vitality, I think, also come with this deconstruction and of this stuff. So, and then of course, as our obvious habits are addressed, the more subtle ones arise. And so this, I think, requires this process that I've been thinking about because there are some pretty deeply ingrained habits of culture that I think many Zen centers are trying to address at this time. And there's how do we find a place where we're safe as well as allow ourselves to be in the midst of chaos? And part of being in the midst of chaos, as I've experienced it, is I have expressed some criticism of my Zen Center, San Francisco Zen Center, for the sort of white face of the institution and how that's lasted for 50 years. It's not something accidental and that sort of thing. And it throws me into this chaos of criticizing people I love and a place that is my home, and then getting the various responses, some of which are very negative and reprimanding. And yet, and my whole body goes into a sort of anxiety about it. But out of that chaos, you know, I see things about myself. I realize, I've also, you know, kind of realized the consequences of my background, which is basically grew up in poverty and somehow ended up, because of various aspects of myself, going to college and that sort of thing, and getting scholarships, and meeting people who, another thing that happened when I was in that Masters of Theology program is, it was one of those rare times where I felt loved for my intellect. And I think, you know, in an anti-intellectual culture like ours, and some of the Zen, sort of atmosphere that can develop, I thought, oh, you know, so these things that I've learned about myself through these stepping into chaos, and then also knowing that I have friends who where I'm safe, and so, you know, they're sort of going in between those places is not just for me, but it also sort of brings others into chaos. Not that I want to, but I think it's necessary, you know? I think we have to go into chaos for something to shift. So I think that Sangha or community is an excellent, wonderful place for that to happen because of that assumption we're going into a safe place, and then we find out we're all different personalities, and we have to negotiate that. It's joyful, and it's awkward, and it's funny, and it's all these different things, but Sangha is, you know, because we've basically decided this is a Zen temple, for instance, we have guidance. We have all the teachings. We have each other's interpretations of them. So there are these areas currently in the more established temples, certainly, that are offering these challenges and opportunities for this understanding of safety and chaos. And those have been the challenge of the pandemic, the examination of white supremacy, and the climate crisis. What are we doing, you know? Here we are in the midst of so many things. And I think we go around and back and forth between what's right and wrong and fantasizing about solutions or that sort of thing. And also that from that fantasizing, we actually may come up with some things that are functional and useful. So I think that in times of this kind of stress and uncertainty, there's also this possibility of gentleness, kind of hearing each other, allowing people to be angry, however that comes out, that sort of thing, distressed, sad, whatever, about any of those areas or anything else. And also looking more deeply into the concerns of our situation in history and our place in them, our complicity. You know, so what is beyond our control, and also how do we address the extent of our complicity? And I know, you know, like in a Dharma talk like this, I'm limited by a topic. And so there's a certain narrowness to the perspective, and I just wanted to acknowledge that I can only include so much. But maybe that's the only way of expressing anything, because otherwise it's completely out of coherent, it becomes incoherent. So I just want to acknowledge that, though, speaking from my place. And that's one of the reasons I deeply appreciate the two titles of Katagiri Roshi's teachings, which is Returning to Silence, and You Have to Say Something. And in a certain way, returning to silence you can see as safety, ease, complacency, and having to say something as entering that chaos. Like, I don't know very many of you, and so I'm risking something by speaking, by talking about my experience, about who I am, and that sort of thing. So I think that that's also another way to see this conversation between silence and you have to say something. So, you know, holding that seeming dichotomy, which is actually, no, I won't digress. But that dichotomy of understanding and then expressing one's understanding, it allows the teachings and the practice itself, which is kind of the foundation out of which we can speak, to take us apart and put us back together, I think, again and again and again. And one way to remember that is not to, at least generally, apply the teachings as judgments or critiques of ourselves or others. That's not really how they function. But to, as hints at balance or non-complacency, and in Buddhist language that is equanimity, and equanimity is one of the least comfortable perspectives. Because it, and it's the most illuminating. So because of that, safety, chaos, equanimity is what holds those, but it's not comfortable. And what I think is also this kind of contradictory way the teachings work, equanimity also offers this experience of deep peace and endurance that can come from that conversation. This, like when I sat down this morning, I'm, you know, okay, I'm in this different place, I don't know anyone, I'm giving a talk, and I sat down and it all just went. I didn't know, expect it, that or anything, and it just, and I could hear the birds, and I could hear that, something sound like a squirrel or something. And I thought, oh, thank you. That's possible. That's part of it. So then we come to the concept of bodhisattva. And that's usually when we project, because a bodhisattva must be somebody who cares about us and agrees with our views and has, you know, the same perspectives, same ideology, and that sort of thing. And I think that this kind of our ideals of the bodhisattva is usually presented as someone who's better than others, you know, more evolved or more compassionate or more capable of living an enlightened life. But bodhisattvas are not doing that. That doesn't put us in that chaos place, which of course we want to be in safety, right? So a description of our ideal world is a world that reflects us back to ourselves as right, as, you know, knowing the truth or something like that. And I think one aspect of the struggle with the bodhisattva archetype may be, you know, this dualistic perception that places ourself and our needs at the center. And this is actually a very reasonable and practical attitude. Well, yeah, you know, if I'm well and I'm happy, then I can help other people. That's true. And yet, if I assume that I deserve those things, or they, you know, they come with the territory or something, then there's a little twist. And so I think that one of the compelling aspects of Zen Buddhist teachings is they put us right into the middle of the struggle, I guess you could call it, to understand, to develop, to become mature. And unraveling the sort of conundrums of the teachings that address our self-centeredness in order to address and question and deconstruct the self is so difficult that we often set it aside. And perfectly reasonable. And at the same time, this deconstruction is also developmental and transformational. That is true is even more of a conundrum. That we have to go to chaos, but then when we go, oh, something happens, and it's extraordinary. And this conundrum of having to take this risk in order to feel that sense of transformation, not only in ourselves, but in our relationships with others, and how we speak to each other and care about each other. So basically, the Buddhist proposal requires an effort made by a person, and that this person achieve the results of that effort through surrender to an insight into no self. And surrender includes deep effort and renunciation, as well as spiritual humor. You know, have to keep remembering. It's an insight into the resistance of the mind and the heart to revelation, and particularly when change is actually inevitable. So all this stuff is happening. And I heard a saying once that the truth hurts and then it sets you free. And it's problematic, but you can also sort of get what it's talking about. And I think in Buddhism, this is reflected in teachings like the precepts, which those list all these things that you're not supposed to do, and then it says I'll vow to do them. And they're all things we do all the time, every single one. So that's how they teach us. I vow not to do this, and yet I do it all the time. And so then they take us apart in that way. And so the first one is not killing. And so how do we accommodate that with the fact that we keep getting in our cars and driving all over the place and polluting, and that we own pets, particularly dogs and cats, which require a huge industry of food production based on meat and fish and chicken and that sort of thing, plus it has to be processed and packaged and transported. And yet, you know, the fact that we have this transportation is how we maintain connections, how we take care of our health and other people's health. And there's love there with our pets that is very nurturing for not just, you know, for our health, for and for that of others, because they get to meet them and they get to meet us who have that support and that sort of thing. So these conundrums of how we destroy what we love and what supports us, and yet how do we not do that, is endless. So one theory I have about ameliorating that is to think of having fewer servants. And the sort of reasonable and innate tendency towards kind of a laziness or complacency of, oh, wouldn't it be great if someone else would do this for me? You know, I didn't have to do this. And one way of doing that is to really appreciate how we've come to possess things like our clothing, for instance, but also our cars, our vehicles, refrigerators and stoves and computers, what that requires. And so this appreciation and caring for these things because of what it's costed others, what it's cost others to bring them to us. And I think Buddhist teachers have been always talking about this as interdependence. You know, we receive these things and we forget what it required for them to get to us. Of course we do, a very human thing. Just keep remembering that. So, I think so in many ways, you know, it would be unkind to ourselves and others to expect that anyone could attain realization or enlightenment based on presupposed or prescribed descriptions and traits. So we can't say this is what a Buddha looks like, or this is what a Bodhisattva looks like, and that's what I have to look like, or others have to look like. I think that's very unkind. They're models for us, but not to be repeated in a certain way. So to forget the self is to no longer base one's life on you know, simply aspirations and desires and aversions, but rather on bringing negation and affirmation into balance. And that's the elusive quality of equanimity within our ordinary circumstances and all these ups and downs of life, which, you know, of our own and others. And Katagiri uses the term harmonious to describe this in a talk about Dogen's Fukan Zazengi. Manifest simplicity. Simplify your life. Because then you can offer yourself to the object. Zazen or study and so on. And then completely simplified, unified, that is what we call harmonious or regulating. Regulating is not to destroy, not to move from one to another. Regulating means that you know all things. First, accept them, and then how to arrange them, how to use the circumstances, the sensory system, movement system, and also the brain nerve system, whatever it is. And then let's sit down in the core of your total personality. So, is it possible to take responsibility for how the world and reality unfold? I would say yes. And in Buddhism, faith in that is not believing or not believing, but this willingness to doubt our preferences and prejudices. The teaching on no self is not negation, but a perspective for transformation and freedom and the ability to offer those possibilities to others and the world. I would say the effort is difficult, but it's also playful, that spiritual humor about how this unfolds, and enjoyable. I mean, just to sit down and for a moment, that was such a pleasure. This simple pleasures like that, this enjoyment. And that's within the great working of what's called emptiness and beauty, as well as horror of the world as it is. My digression earlier was going to be about emptiness, but I would just briefly say that that is the context in which safety, chaos, relative and absolute function and are in conversation with each other. So thank you very much. And now if anyone has questions or comments. Whether you're online or
how do you see balancing the idea of no gain with this thing you're talking about moving into chaos? Because it almost seems like moving into chaos with intention to achieve something.
What was the moving into chaos as an intention to achieve?
To achieve something.
Oh. Well, actually, it's not the attention to achieve, more it's the intention to deconstruct, to let go. Because in chaos, you have nothing to hold on to. And so you don't know what's going to happen. You take this risk, and then you don't, and often, you know, in my case, I don't even know why I'm doing it. In a sense of purpose, you know, gain. But I know that something has to be expressed for my kind of intention of risking myself to see who I am. So, and then that, and how others perceive me, like what will be their response. So I don't think that's quite in the gaining realm, although I understand what you're asking. I think it's more this intention to just go into the mystery of how things work without sort of, in the 10 ox herding pictures, there's one picture where the commentary is about how, you're no longer so polite, you know? and I think there's something in there about how there's this strain a little bit that we maintain. And then sort of stepping into chaos is risking that a little bit. Is that?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you. Oops. Yes.
Thinking about like the form and emptiness and like kind of the self and no self dichotomy, sometimes I think about it along those lines of sort of like cultivation and letting go. Mm-hmm. Cultivation is kind of like, I'm in the self, you know, I have this like to-do list, I'm gonna get it done. And then letting go is just, yeah, kind of, you know, not doing that. And I feel in my own practice is sort of a vacillation. You know, sometimes it is more appropriate to like be more proactive, and sometimes it's more appropriate to step back. And I also notice there's sort of a shadow side of the stepping back, which is supposedly more the emptiness side, but then it's sort of like can hinge on just falling back to factory settings. You know, I'm just like the personality and just like the default, I'm just gonna like eat this enormous bowl of popcorn and then like watch TV, you know. So I don't know if that makes sense, but I was wondering if you have any comments on like how to sort of like manage that like teetering, you know, because it seems like it's rich there.
Right. Well, again, the safety, the sort of returning to silence part does include returning to complacency, because that's part of where our safety is. And I think that judging that and saying, I shouldn't be doing that, is kind of it's just like, that's the going back to the habits. Going back to doing it and saying, I know I am doing this, I need safety. I want to go back to this habit that I know, so that I can be safe for this time, and to know that that's why you're doing it, rather than saying, I shouldn't be doing it. And then going to the chaos, I don't want to do this. And then not doing, and not worrying, not sort of saying, I have to be right, I have to say the right words, I have to be, you know, good, perfect, I have to be wonderful. Then not seeing that going to chaos as that. And sort of that's the freedom, not to have that extra thing of judging yourself and others. Because you'll see someone else, you know, with their popcorn and watching a movie and wasting their time, blah, 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 you know. So that's what I think gets sort of taken out.
So it's kind of like knowing reducing what you're doing and why you're doing it.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, I think. Yeah.
Thank you. I mean, really appreciate this talk. Kind of both of the comments that brought up in me that, like you said, when I'm thrown in chaos, when I notice I'm in chaos, right, there's this immediate grasping to control, you know. So it is about the opening, the letting go of that grasping, that need that begins to start to unravel stuff that I can actually look at and see if I'm just touching it lightly, right? To me, it's like this, like touching everything lightly. And then it falls away. It seems to just take me to a place if I'm willing to allow it to, like willing to allow it to. Because in my personal 12-step program, controlling has been a big, you know, thing about how when I'm in my illness, when I try to make things perfect, when I try to control things, and that's when I really know that I'm in insanity. So I appreciate you bringing it up.
And how natural it is to want to control things, to make things more comfortable and better, you know?
Yeah.
And also, I think we forget that there's also values in there.
Yes.
Like underneath the tense part of it, there's actually these values of, yeah, it would be nice to walk into a nice environment, for instance, for people who like to set things up for guests or something like that. It's so lovely, you know, to have people. So there's that piece of it too, like a gentleness with ourselves that we actually have skills that don't have to be thrown out the window. They're just calming the tendencies and stuff.
Yeah, Tim has brought up a lot in his talks around, you know, like being on the ocean, right? Just, mm-hmm. you know, being on the ocean, right?
Yeah.
You're you're riding this big wave, right? And if you, you know, if you're going to resist and thrash, it's not going to, it may not be helpful, you know, but eventually it'll calm down and still you're riding a smaller wave. And,
mm-hmm. So. Yeah, it's a nice way to look at it too. Thank you, Kim. Time for one more.
You mentioned in development and almost maturity, maybe a goal or kind of this deconstruction. Is there something you said then that that there's an immature part with going around the extreme and you're on the middle?
No. Not sure if I understand, I'm sorry.
I guess it's the middle ways, this is what we, Buddha teaches.
So the middle, okay, so when I talk about development and maturity, it's this, you know, kind of pretty standard in human history and in spiritual history, is this what the maturity is and the developmental part is this ability to sustain oneself and also be calm. Or, you know, that's what equanimity, because equanimity sort of is about this conversation between our need to survive and our need to accommodate ourselves to the world. So if you're so much worried about survival and you're hoarding things and, you know, trying to get all that you and whoever you care about needs and not care about the world and your relationship to it, then you'll remain in this, in a kind of non-developed state, non-mature state. Is that sort of, okay, something like that. So it's a lot of it is about grasping, but it's so hard to understand it because that's so reasonable, you know, that it would be a relief. It's hard to sort of process.
Thank you everybody for coming today. Right, I will.